Hey there, welcome to another episode of the Envision Podcast. My name is Karthik and I will be your host for today's episode. On this podcast, we bring together people who have a positive impact on the blind and visually impaired community from across the world and share their stories with you. Today on the podcast, we have Dr. Hobby Wedler. Dr. Hobby Wedler is an insightful and passionate thinker who loves to bring people together to help them see new possibilities. Hobby has been completely blind since birth. He is a scientist, an entrepreneur, driven by his passion for innovative, creative, and insightful thinking. He co-founded Hobbies, which is a food and beverage products and services company. And on this podcast, we'll talk to him today about his life, blind wine tasting, chemistry, and everything about the senses. Welcome, Hobby. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Karthik, it's an absolute honor. I love what you guys do at Envision, and I'm really, really excited to be featured on this show. So thank you very much. How are you today?
I'm doing good. The weather is really nice here in the Netherlands. It's been sunny all week with occasional rain, but that's typical Dutch weather. How are things at yours?
Oh, things are good. You know, the weather is, we're experiencing a little bit of a drought here in Northern California, so it's warm and dry today, but that's okay.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. So we always begin this podcast with getting to know and, you know, sort of, you know, to understanding where you come from and your origin story. So can you talk to us about, you know, your life when you were a kid, when you were growing up, and when did science become a passion for you?
Oh, man, that's a great question. So, as you said in the intro, I was born completely blind, and, you know, that can go one of two ways. Parents can either really, you know, accept that and say, okay, let's do what we need to do and figure out how to best accommodate our son. Or they can say, oh no, what do we do? You know, and have really low expectations. And my parents chose the first route. They said, wow, this is a challenge, but we're up for anything. And, we're gonna believe in our son and, you know, show him that there's no substitute for hard work. Now they needed to do some learning themselves about how to work with and teach their blind child, and they worked with some great people to do that. I'll just start out by saying that they were really nervous and didn't know what to do for about 12 hours after I was born, and my mom decided it was time that she called her best friend from college and let her and her husband know that I was born and that I'm healthy and all that. So she called her friend, Barb is her name, the friend's name, and Barb's husband Steve answered the phone, and Steve was saying, All the friend could hear was, oh no, oh, that's just terrible. Oh gosh, I don't know what we're going to be able to do about this. And Barb, being, you know, very eager to know things right away, you know, took the phone from Steve and said, what's going on? You know, what am I hearing? And my parents shared with her that, well, Hobie was born, but he's blind and they don't know if he'll ever get his sight back. And Barb said, oh, the way that Steve was talking, I thought he was dead. Blind is a lot better than dead. We can deal with blind. And they, you know, she said, this is not a problem at all. That's what she told my parents. And they said, not a problem. We're still worried about it. And I'll tell you why this woman and, you know, Barb knew that it wasn't really a problem, you know, being blind, is because she was raised by her father, whose best friend was a completely blind man, who was a professor. He did everything around their house. That was totally him. That was what he did. And, being blind didn't look abnormal. It was just totally fine. And my parents said, oh, wow. Okay. So there are successful blind people out there. That's great. You know, that's really good to know. And, from that point forward, they embraced it. You know, they said, okay, my parents are very hardworking people, by the way. And they said, well, we're just going to do this. We're going to figure out how to make this exactly work for our son. So they ended up working very early on with a group called the Blind Babies Foundation, which is a great group out of Northern California who totally embraced and assisted parents of blind children and showed them that, you know, there all the possibilities out there. This is how, you know, he can't, when you're going and doing something in the kitchen, a sighted child is going to learn so much. But your blind child can't, so you have to explain what you're doing. And something as simple as that made such a difference. And I'll give you an example. You know, if you were to get your kid a piece of toast with butter on it, and the kid was sighted, your kid would see you open the bread box, get a loaf of bread, you know, cut it, put the bread in the toaster, you know, toast it, grab a plate out of the other cupboard, put the bread on the plate, go to the refrigerator, get the butter out of the refrigerator, put some butter on the bread with a knife that you, you know, got from another silverware drawer, and then, you know, grab a napkin from another place and then set this thing down. So to your sighted child, the bread didn't just appear in front of them toasted. But if you do the same thing and you have a blind child and you don't explain exactly what you're doing or let them do it with you, they're never going to learn. Things just sort of appear out of nowhere. And that's not really, you know, that's not the right way to do it, in my opinion. It's like you gotta let people learn and do things on their, you know, with you, and so they can learn from it, right? If you didn't, you know, if you just let the blind kid sit there and not tell them anything, they wouldn't have any idea. So that's how I learned a lot. My parents were and still are amazing role models, and they just from a very young age were tour guides, describing exactly what they did as they did it, and really making sense out of it for me, which was just absolutely wonderful. And it gave me an insight into things happening around me all the time. I actually first got excited about science. I remember it. You know, we did all of our own work on our house, first of all. So it was, you know, my sighted brother and I were, my brother's 2 years older, and he and I, you know, the expectations were high, and they expected us to have high expectations of them, which we did. But you know, working hard was not an issue. You know, we would go out and, you know, would go to school for 6 hours and come home, and it wasn't abnormal at all to do homework for 3 or 4 hours and then go work on the house until dark. And I remember the day specifically in April of 1992, I was 4 years old, about to turn five. And, you know, I'd done this hundreds of times in the past, but I turned on the water tap, you know, in the kitchen sink, and noticed that, okay, water's coming out. That's what always happens. But it dawned on me to think of, wait a minute, where is this water actually coming from? This is pretty amazing that we get water, you know, filtering out of the tap right to us. How is this happening? Where is this coming from? I need to understand this better. And that led me to really understand that, wow, water is actually pressurized by the city and carried to all the houses, you know, through a system of pipes. And it was like, wow, this is really incredible to think about and learn about. And it involved me, you know, calling the Department of Water Resources, going and taking a field trip there, et cetera, in order to really figure out what the mechanism was that brought the water to us. I remember a few years later turning on the vacuum cleaner and having it roar to life and say, how can I plug this thing into a little plug in the wall, have it make all this noise and create all this suction and be able to clean my floor with it? This doesn't make sense either. And I did a whole investigation of, well, how do vacuums work, and learned, oh, wow, these things work. Because, you know, yes, electrons are flowing into the vacuum and flowing out the other side. But I thought, you know, electrons are everywhere. We must not be paying for electrons when we buy electricity. And then I realized that, no, we're paying for the electromotive force or the voltage that pushes them along. And, you know, my parents would do, we would do everything together. We would hike. Fairly early on, I was 10 years old. My dad grew up sailing, so he bought a sailboat, and we would sail a lot on the weekends. And I learned, you know, that no, nothing was off limits. That was the amazing thing. Really, nothing was off limits or unapproachable or anything like that. So it was just really exciting and really a great, rich childhood that laid the foundation for so much more. So it was really, I feel very blessed and appreciative that I got the parents that I got, because they're incredible people.
Yeah, you know, I mean, listening to your story, I can really see that, you know, when you, not just someone who, you know, not just a kid who might be blind or visually impaired, but I think when any kid is sort of brought up without, you know, without having a certain limit on what they can do, or without being made to feel that there is a limit to what they can do, it does lead to some amazing things. And you know, how when did chemistry become a passion? Because, you know, I'm asking that because it's one of those really fundamental sciences, right? Yeah. And did you know that, you know, you were really passionate about chemistry from an early age, or was it an interest that did develop over a period of time?
You know, it's a great question. And I think many people might answer this question similarly to how I'm going to answer it. But so much of success for us is about an excellent high school instructor. So I had a wonderful chemistry teacher in high school. And actually, she was the same person who I took physical science from. And when we got, you know, covering a little bit of physics, a little bit of earth science, chemistry, this sort of thing. When we got to chemistry, it was just really exciting because she made, you know, you could tell it was her passion. She made that just so much fun. And I'd always, even in junior high school, I was good at chemistry for whatever reason I could think about it, but she made it incredibly exciting and wonderful to think about and to study. You know, it was interesting for me because she would often tell, you know, when we were in class and she was speaking, addressing the class, she would say things like, "Oh man, chemistry is everything. It's how the world works. It's, you know, it's the science of life, basically. It's what you eat. It's what you drink. It's, you know, biology is built on chemistry, and the fundamentals, all the fundamental elements are chemistry. You know, so if you understand chemistry, you understand so much of the world around you, you all should think about pursuing chemistry further." And I think I might have been the only one in the class who was sitting there saying, "Yeah, I love this. That sounds great. You know, and, you know, this is what I want to do." But then I would go talk to her, you know, outside of class and say, "Hey, I really like chemistry. I think this is what I want to do. You know, how do I go about doing that?" And she'd say, "Oh, Hobie, you know, you're blind. I don't know how doable this is going to be. You know, chemistry is just so visual. You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to have assistants all the time? How are you going to make it through?" And I said, "I don't know if I really need an assistant all the time. And, you know, well, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I really want to study chemistry further." And she was just not optimistic about it at all. And I eventually said, "Okay, I know what I can say that's going to help her understand this better, where I'm coming from." And I approached her one day. I still remember, it was second semester of that honors chemistry course that I was in. And because I got into honors chemistry, and at that point she was kind of like, "Well, what am I supposed to do? How do I, you know, I can't say no because he tested in, but I'm really nervous about making it accessible." We figured out how to make her class accessible, but it was that second semester in honors chemistry when I went to her and I said, "You know, I understand that you think chemistry is a visual science, but I have to tell you that nobody can see atoms. You can't see atoms, I can't see them, and chemistry is really quite cerebral. We might use our eyesight to understand what's going on in a reaction, but and you know, see maybe a gas getting evolved or a color change or that sort of thing. There are so many other things that we need to test in chemistry that we can't see, that we rely on other ways of testing and understanding." And she thought about that for a little while and said, "Okay, wow, you really have a point there." And from that point on, became a total ally of mine and supporter, and supported me all the way through my college chemistry, on into graduate school, and just totally there for me and totally excited and supportive.
That's amazing, you know, and you're right. I mean, a lot of people that I've spoken to in this podcast, there's always that one really pivotal person that believes in them early on, and that seems to make like a ton of difference in how things turn out. And this was actually also one of the things that I had as a question, you know, because I was talking about this podcast, with one of my friends over the weekend, and I was saying I'm going to talk to someone who's a very renowned chemist, and you know, who is also blind from birth. And one of the first things he said was, you know, I think he or she, you know, like, would need to sort of visualize chemistry because it's very visual feel, like you said, with the whole you know, different experiments and stuff like that. But how do you really approach that, you know, how do you really approach chemistry that way? You know, do you use any special methods to make the whole you know, the experiments that you do more accessible, or what would you say to someone like that, you know, who thinks that chemistry is a very visual science and you need to be able to, like, you know, visualize or see the things that that happen and then perform experiments and such?
Well, what's funny actually is that the field of chemistry that I really fell in love with in college was organic chemistry. And organic chemistry is arguably the most visual chemistry of them all, because you're looking at drawings of molecules and making deductions and understanding them and figuring out exactly how, you know, how the chemistry works, basically looking at carbon-containing molecules and really mapping out where atoms should go in space, you know, from one structure to another, you know, basically how atoms connect to form molecules. And everybody said, oh, this is going to be the hardest for you. This is visual. I don't know how you're going to do it. I said, yeah, I don't know either. Let's see. Part of the way that I did it is I had an amazing, amazing assistant who worked with me. I was just so blessed and lucky to find her who worked with me to make chemistry more accessible and available to me. She happened to know a lot of math and science. She was an MIT graduate and would actually work with me and draw out molecular structures so I could feel them. So I'm definitely indebted to her for that. But what I would say from my perspective is that I, how do I say this? I've been using my sense, my need for visualization all the way since day one for my survival when I travel around as a blind person. And, you know, when I think about, let's say I'm walking from my house to the local supermarket, I think about that route in my mind, and I then go along that route and do what I need to do and know exactly where I'm gonna turn, and you know it's in my mind, right? I visualize it. If I'm standing in my backyard, I like to garden, envisioning my garden where certain plants are. That's all in my head, right? It's all something that I have to think about. And if I'm standing in front of a group of people giving a talk, you know, I envision them sitting in front of me. I don't see them with my eyes, but I visualize that. And I'm very good at spatial sort of awareness and visualizing things in my mind and placing them in my mind, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, one thing kind of led to another, and I realized that, okay, wait a minute. I tend to be particularly strong with understanding how things fit together in chemistry and thinking about molecular structures in my mind. I can build them as large as I need to be and do chemistry on them. Why is this? And I said, yeah, it all clicked that I was actually using my brain, I think, and I'd be curious to put myself in an MRI sometime and find out if this is true, but I believe that my brain is, you know, so much of what I do in terms of visualization, excuse me, is similar to what I do, what I think about how to navigate my surroundings, to the point that thinking about how to add an alcohol group, a hydroxyl group to an organic molecule isn't all that different than thinking about how to get from the chemistry building at my college campus to the local bus stop, you know. So that's really what it is that you know, that I'm working on, that I'm doing, and that's how I visualize chemistry. While in graduate school, I actually studied computational organic chemistry. So we ran calculations basically on chemical structures using predetermined, you know, sort of algorithms, if you will, on a supercomputer, and we would get back data that would ultimately tell us, you know, exactly what the structure, how the structure changed, basically looking for a lower energy conformation and how pieces of that structure sort of moved around. And we use this to study organic reaction mechanisms. So why electrons go where they go to turn one thing into another. And my sighted peers can use graph, you know, just look at a graphical user interface and see what's happening on the screen in front of them. Whereas I, you know, couldn't do that. So I'd either work with an assistant who would describe what they see, and then I could access all the text data, all the energy data myself. But that was, I needed someone to help me access the visual data on the screen. I said, wait a minute, do we really need to have a person here? And the answer was not really. You know, we can do this other ways. So we got a 3D printer. And when we got a 3D printer, we ultimately said, okay, what can we do with this? And we created a script in collaboration with a group that's no longer there, actually an academic group out of the Netherlands, you know, that would actually pull the structural coordinates out of my calculation files and put them into STL files, which are 3D printable files, and I could print out my structures. And then literally I could read off of the, you know, we coded it with Braille, so I could read off of the chemical bonds, the bond length, I could code in bond angles, each atom had a different texture, and that works really well. 3D printing still takes a long time, so it's still kind of a proof of concept, if you will. But no, it was a really exciting process to use 3D printing to understand how things fit together, how things work. And, you know, allowed me to really do a lot of my chemistry accessibly. I will say that, you know, my big desire was to do as much chemistry as I could in the research group that I was in with as minimal as possible sighted assistance. So I would say about 30% of my PhD dissertation was actually based on accessibility. How do I make chemistry more, you know, the projects that I'm doing more accessible to me? And how can we, you know, make chemistry more accessible to people, you know, beyond me, who follow me? And we published those papers, and that information is also published in my dissertation, all the way down to how can we make an experimental lab space safe to a blind researcher. And then about 70% of my dissertation was actually hardcore chemistry, you know, doing research, gaining chemical findings, and moving that way. So that's a lot of what I've done, how I've done it, and that's the bottom line.
Wow, no, that's actually seriously cool because, you know, if I understand correctly, it's really amazing that, you know, you're able to transform those equations into a 3D printed, you know, structure that you could then go ahead and, you know, read with Braille and then, right, you know, do your chemistry. And that's one of the things that I find also really interesting about the community that, you know, we're all part of, that, you know, we're constantly pushing the boundaries of today's technology. And I don't know, I've never heard of this style of doing chemistry before. It was a necessity for you, right? I mean, you had to really...
It was a necessity. And really, but what I want to say that's interesting is that it not only helped me, but having 3D molecular structures that my sighted peers could hold on to actually helped them see things they didn't see before. So it's like, you know, my whole rule is that if you do one thing to help one group of people, you want it to help everybody else. And this one I think really did and does, because it helps people visualize things better. And I'll just say that one of the funny things is when looking at chemical structures, I think I had a bit of an advantage over some of my sighted peers because I never had to use my mind and my imagination to visualize things. I think I had a bit of a leg up in some cases over my sighted peers and an advantage because I, for my whole life, have to, you know, rely on my mind to imagine things and make sense of them. And, you know, my sighted peers never really have had to do chemistry that way and think about chemistry that way. So it, and you know, they look at it on paper, and sometimes what you look at on, you know, on paper in two dimensions can be deceiving as to what it actually becomes in three dimensions. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, and I think it also touches on a topic, or rather this sort of affirms one of the things that keeps coming up in the podcast over and over again, that, you know, when you make something inclusive, or when you, you know, make a field or a product or a space more inclusive, then it also not just becomes, it not just helps people who are blind, visually impaired, or, you know, people with disability, but it really improves the lives of everybody, right? Like how you mentioned, where, you know, all of a sudden your necessity of 3D printing your molecules not just helped you, but then it also helped your sighted peers to see things in completely new ways than they would have been able to before.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I really think that, you know, if we help one group with one thing, we want that to help so many other people. And my sort of simple analogy to that is, think about wheelchair ramps, our pavement access points for wheelchairs. You know, it was a big deal in the United States when we put these in, and it was, people complained because it was going to cost so much money. They did it in one city, actually, in California. It's not too far from where I am, in Berkeley, California, and they saw, wow, these really do make a difference. And soon enough, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed and mandated wheelchair ramps in all on all intersections. But like, if you think about the number of people now who use those ramps to get, you know, up and down from the sidewalk, think about anyone on a bicycle, pushing a stroller, pushing a cart full of groceries, you know, whatever you may be doing, if you're a skateboarder or you're pulling a rolling suitcase or whatever you might be doing, it definitely, these wheelchair ramps definitely do assist and make a huge difference as we go about our work and what we do. So I would just say, you know, it's quite amazing what they how they help us and what they do for us. And they were intended for one group, people in wheelchairs. I read a case study a few months ago that said that the group people in wheelchairs literally make up about less than 2% of the total people that use wheelchair ramps on a daily basis, you know?
Wow. No, that's actually that's a really interesting statistic, and it shows that, yeah, inclusive design helps a lot of people, not just people with disabilities. And the thing that you know, I mean, moving forward from that point on, was this whole love affair with chemistry the reason why you also started a nonprofit organization that helps blind, visually impaired students, mentoring them, and so on, right? Like, can you talk to us a little bit about that?
My love for chemistry, you know, got me into science and made it so that I was just determined. And I feel like with the right mindset, anybody can do anything they want. You know, what really prompted me to start the nonprofit, by the way, the nonprofit held annual chemistry camps for 6 years for blind and visually impaired high school students and even early college students, young college students. And we would do hands-on chemistry experiments and show them that, you know, they can do whatever they want, no matter how visual it seems, and they really shouldn't let their eyesight hold them back. The reason I started Accessible Science, which is the nonprofit, was to really show students, you know, because I felt like I had had all these opportunities. I figured out how to make chemistry accessible to me. I figured out some good tools to use to do it, and I helped some other blind students in some national programs done by the National Federation of the Blind, but I'd never had the opportunity to step out there and, you know, help other students learn their potential. That's what I wanted to do. And I just wanted to do it for local students. I was thinking about doing a couple of different day camps and this sort of thing. One thing led to another, and, you know, soon we had students from all over the world joining us and learning from us. My goal was to just help other blind students and empower other blind students to do, you know, as much as they could themselves and to feel really, really good about themselves when teachers and maybe even parents tell them that, oh no, you know, you like science, but science is fairly impractical, you know. So I really love whenever I get the chance to inspire and change people's ways of thinking and change their lives a little bit. It just, it really makes me happy. We also at Accessible Science Chemistry Camps made sure that we had blind people helping other blind people. So students were paired with mentors who were blind, like three students or four students to a mentor. And then the instructors were a combination of blind and sighted folks, mostly me and people who are graduate students and professors at UC Davis. And actually my science teacher from high school heard about this and got so excited that she came back and totally helped out with it each year, and was just a really strong supporter of it. So that was great, and I just loved that opportunity to do chemistry camp and really hopefully inspire some kids to study what they want.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that, you know, it will have a positive impact, because I can really see you as being really passionate about this space. And since you are in some ways a pioneer for accessible chemistry, I think it opens up new doors for people in the future. And I think in the same year, you know, when I was just reading about you on the internet, also have a really interesting experience that you've created, which is a truly blindfolded wine experience called Tasting in the Dark, right?
Yeah.
Could you talk to us a bit about that? You know, it's really fun, because I've been to a few wine tastings, and I know the importance of smell and taste and color. But I think this stuff sounds really, really interesting.
So I'll just go back a little bit and say that you know, my goal in going to graduate school in chemistry was to teach, right? That's mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. I wanted to teach. I wasn't, and still am not, interested in a career of chemistry research. I really wanted to teach, and I wanted to teach because I've always kind of had the heart of a teacher. You know, I've always been really excited to get people excited about things maybe they didn't know they were excited about. It's just been a huge goal and passion of mine. And I don't want to be the teacher that just the know-it-all that says, oh, I know more than you, and this is what you need to know. No, I want to be the teacher that comes in and really, really carefully and accurately shows someone something that maybe they didn't know or they didn't know they loved before, and get them thrilled about it. So when I taught, you know, my desire with teaching chemistry was to get students excited about studying, you know, understanding chemistry at a very beginning stage. So I wanted to be that professor who walked into the lecture hall at the college with, you know, 500 or 600 students in it, all freshman chemistry students at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning, and make chemistry exciting to, you know, a couple of them when really 90%+ of those students are only there to, you know, as a prerequisite for what they think they actually want to study. And I had the honor, I was so honored in graduate school to get the opportunity to actually teach a few chemistry classes to freshman chemistry students. And what I realized then, Karthik, is that students didn't really speak chemistry. So I knew how to describe chemistry really well, and I had slides that showed what I was describing, you know, in equations or whatever, and I was able to walk students through things, but students didn't like to speak chemistry. They wanted the professor to write on the board and point at things and show video animations and all of these sort of visual things, and they also didn't read the book. And I think if students were to read the book, they would be able to speak chemistry better and know what the terms meant a little more. But not having read the book, I think it was very challenging for them. And, you know, I would spend the majority of my time and money, frankly, working with assistants who I had to pay to make my, you know, to make these beautiful pictures and video animations and all these sorts of things, and then have to really memorize them and understand them and, you know, internalize them, which took time as well, so that I could present them coherently. So I decided after getting my PhD that maybe a career in chemistry teaching was just more work than it was worth and required more assistance than it was worth. So I like to say that it took me getting a PhD in chemistry to realize that that's not what I wanted my career to be. And if it takes you a PhD to realize that's not what you want to do, a PhD in a subject to realize that's not what you want to do, I'd say you've gone too far with it. Or you're a Gemini like myself and just have a hard time making decisions. But what's interesting is I've always been, you know, I think once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And I've always had this sort of entrepreneurial vein in me, you know, just wanting to start businesses to solve real problems is really how I describe it. And, you know, Tasting in the Dark originated when I actually got a call from Francis Ford Coppola's wine team. Francis Ford Coppola is a filmmaker, by the way, and producer. And I got a call from his wine team, his wineries in Northern California, because his, you know, equally large passion to wine, or to filmmaking, is wine. When I got a call from his team and they said, hey, Francis wants you to innovate a truly blindfolded wine experience for him. He went and did an experience in Asia and he thought it was okay, but it was not authentic because it wasn't led by a blind person. You know, are you interested in joining our team and working on this? And it was very part-time, and I said yes. When Francis Ford Coppola asks you to do something, you say yes, and then you hang up and you realize what you said yes to, and you freak out a little bit.
He probably, sorry to interrupt you there, but, you know, I just had this really corny joke. I mean, he probably made you an offer you couldn't refuse.
He did. It's like, well, Coppola wants you to work with him. He's this famous filmmaker. Yeah, of course I'm going to say yes.
Yeah, he's the guy who made The Godfather for anyone who didn't catch that attempt at a joke of mine because
it's great. I love that joke because it's so Godfather right there. But, you know, I ended up working with Coppola and building out this experience, and it was a great hospitality experience that really, really took shape. And what we do is we essentially blindfold people and then walk them down a fairly long path into the room where we do the tasting. And, you know, when we temporarily remove eyesight, we find that people have such a better ability to understand their surroundings and understand what's going on around them. And it really makes for an incredible, I think, an incredible experience and way for people to understand wine and have a conversation where they're not distracted by their eyesight. And I say eyesight here very deliberately because I truly believe that all of us have vision. Some of us just might lack eyesight. It's amazing. I am very careful not to make the blindfold feel like a game or feel like any sort of fun game of the experience. The blindfold is there to really focus our attention and make it so that we're not distracted by our eyesight. And we sit down and we smell a variety. We talk about wine. We introduce each other, talk a little bit about each other, really address wine as a true art form. And then I make aroma samples that are actual spices and things that people might smell that I think are found in the wines that, you know, that they're drinking, that we're tasting. So we do that and we pass those around and people, it sort of calibrates their palate. And then we sit and we deeply analyze first the aroma and then the flavor of anywhere from 4 to 6 or even 4 to 8 wines in certain cases. And it really is a lot of fun and wonderful to do that and get people to understand and value and appreciate wine for what it is. And, you know, this whole idea of the tasting in the dark really took off with the Coppola sales team. So I ended up doing a lot of work around the country, actually, as the wine educator of record for the company, hosting these experiences for clients, you know, people that we want to take on as wholesale clients. And that, you know, led me to my other entrepreneurial work, which is a lot of fun and having to do with the senses. But it was really the beginning of that tasting, which happened ironically concurrent with my graduate tenure. But my advisor let me travel and knew that this might be a path for me in the future. And considering that my laptop, what I'm sitting here in front of right now, was my laboratory, it was okay to travel. You know, it made it okay to travel around and do things. So that was great, you know, and really a positive overall experience. And so much fun to build out that tasting. And it allows me to teach and do what I love doing in education as well. Maybe wine education, but it's still getting people excited about things that maybe they didn't realize they could be excited about.
Yeah, and it really is interesting that you have your background in chemistry to become some sort of a sensory expert in a sense, right? Because yeah. I think, you know, I do want to talk, you know, touch upon your other entrepreneurial venture, Hobies, which is, you know, which we just said in the intro is a food and beverages services and product companies. And, you know, you're working on a whole new bunch of products. Could you talk to us a bit about that? Could you walk us through that entrepreneurial journey of yours?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I've got a couple of companies right now. First of all, I think that multi-sensory branding is really important. And I love to be creative in what I do. And that means that, you know, a brand that we create doesn't only look good, but it has to feel good and resonate with customers all the way through from one, you know, from end to end. So I do a lot of sensory branding and multi-sensory marketing. So to that end, I have a little marketing firm called SensePoint, which I co-founded about 3 years ago, that does a lot of work not in the food and beverage business. And then Hobies is my purely food and beverage brand, and that's my real passion right now. So Hobies is going to be launching both our products and services websites very soon. Really, what I do at Hobies is I, through food and beverage and through sensory insight and expertise in food and beverage and beyond, I elevate happiness. How do we elevate happiness? Well, in products, you know, I am working on creating either food and beverage products themselves or products to make the food and beverage experience more enjoyable, whether that be a nice glass to drink wine out of or whatever the case may be. And the products that we're launching with later this month, actually, are seasoning, gourmet seasoning products. We're starting with two. And I'm just so excited because and the problem, you know, as an entrepreneur, entrepreneurship for me is absolutely not about money or power. It's about solving a real problem and feeling good about solving the problem. And the problem that we're solving with Hobies is actually very simple. You know, we have not been able to find products, seasonings and that sort of thing on the market better than the ones that that we have always made for all these years at home. So we decided, well, what's the point in holding back? Let's make these products available to the public and move forward from there. So that's what we're doing with Hobies, and it's just a really exciting and wonderful journey. And when I say elevate happiness, we use flavor to enhance those moments that matter and really make them even better than they already were. Whether you're, you know, eating dinner on Tuesday night, or you're celebrating a great accomplishment of your child, or you're at your child's wedding or at your own wedding. You know, we want to, any moment in life, really life is defined by so many moments. And if we can enhance those and make them just even that much better through food and beverage, well, that's our goal. And that's what we try to do on a daily basis. And on the services side, Hobie's, it really, what I do is sensory strategy. So for food and beverage, also for packaging teams that want to make packaging more accessible and desirable to the senses, and anything goes there. It can even be, you know, corporate helping with accessibility design of products, you know, making products more accessible, like washers and dryers and stoves and that sort of thing. And really there, what we do is we have a motto, which is perceive to understand. And once we understand, we can appreciate. And once we appreciate, we can, you know, use that appreciation to drive success and achievement. So perceive, right? We go through and we work with you as a you know, in our business to business model to really understand what it is that your product is currently, whether it's a package that, you know, that you want to understand how sensory, you know, perfected it is. We look at what it is now. If it's a food or beverage, we really taste it and understand all the nuances. And then we think about, okay, what do you like about it? And what do you want changed about it? And I make some recommendations. And then we make the changes that we need in order for them to really appreciate what it is that they do or that they sell. Maybe they were kind of stuck and we have to just sort of rekindle, if you will, that appreciation. So we do that. And that's a lot of fun to really recreate that appreciation, you know? And once we do that, and that appreciation gives us the power to, you know, say, okay, now you're super happy with what you have. So we elevated their happiness, which allows them to go out with their product and sell it and talk about it and be honestly proud of it and own it, right? And that ownership of it makes it so much easier for them to sell it in the best possible way. So that's a lot of what we do. We love it. I love the Hobie's company, and I love what we're doing and how we're growing it. It's just, it's my brainchild, and it's so exciting to me.
No, I mean, it sounds really, really exciting. And I think, you know, we need more people from the community to come out into the world, build these companies, and advise other mainstream companies on how they can actually really improve accessibility. And, you know, I know that throughout your life you've got a lot of accolades. I mean, you had President Obama calling you a champion for change to help, yeah. you know, for your work that you've done in mentoring people with disabilities and improving their employment opportunities. You've also been named Forbes 30 Under 30, you know, in the whole food category. All of this stuff is you know, something that you've achieved. And I think, you know, more than that, I think the remarkable work that you've been doing to mentor, you know, high school kids and really make chemistry more accessible, that to me stands out a lot. So, you know, we usually end these podcasts by asking our guests what's the one guiding principle in their life that they would like to share with the listeners. You know, what's your mantra, Hobie?
My mantra is believe in yourself, because you can do anything you want. And the only way that you can do anything you want is with a positive, open mindset. Anything is possible. I used to try to work with negative people. I can't surround myself with negative people anymore because it makes me negative, and I am not willing to do that. So I hang out with positive people. I just think that anything is doable. And the way that you know that is by challenging yourself. So challenge yourself every opportunity you get. Take challenges on, and then when you succeed at them and achieve them, you will feel so proud of your success, and it just motivates you to raise those expectations up. But mindset is everything, and I want to get to know everybody. I have an abundance mindset. The more people I can have in my life, the better. It just makes me so happy to know people and to get out there and just really, you know, really push forward in the most positive and meaningful possible way. And that's what I do every day. And I'm always, you know, not afraid to fail. You got to make mistakes to learn, and you learn from those mistakes, and you just go far because of that, you know, and life is doable. So my motto is live life to the fullest, embrace happiness, live with a positive mindset, and have really high expectations of yourself and people around you. And also, just be respectful. You gotta be respectful of everybody around you. And you can command respect by being, you know, by representing your utmost respect for people in the world. And that's really what it's all about for me. No different. Wow.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's amazing. And to have high expectations of yourself and to believe anything is possible is really, you know, it's something that I'm sure invigorates a lot of people who are listening to the podcast. And with that, we come to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening in on today's podcast, everyone. And we really hope you enjoyed the talk with Hobie. For more inspirational talks, stay tuned, and we'll be back very soon with a new episode.